This is The Record on KUOW. At a tea house in the Panama Hotel in Seattle's International District, there's a window in the floor back near the end of it. And when you look down, you see dusty old luggage and bags. Those are the possessions of Japanese Americans who were sent to internment camps during World War II. In all, more than 120,000 people were taken from their homes and sent to what President Roosevelt called concentration camps for no reason other than their ethnicity. Richard Reeves tells the story in his new book called Infamy, The Shocking Story of the Japanese-American Internment During World War II. Richard Reeves, a best-selling author and an award-winning journalist. Thank you so much for coming by. We appreciate it.
Thanks. I'm very glad to be here.
Remind us of the history. What was the justification for relocating many of these people? Many of them were U.S. citizens.
Two-thirds of them were American citizens. Well, it began when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And there was a first wave. The FBI had a list. It was really a list of people who were prominent, if they were teachers, journalists, priests, businessmen of some note or whatnot. And there were about 5,000 of them on the West Coast. They were all enemy aliens, by law enemy aliens, because they did not have American citizenship, because between 1924 in 1952, Japanese could not get American citizenship, so they remained citizens of Japan. Their children, the Nisei, the second generation, were Americans. They had been born here. But the first thing the government did, in this case it was the FBI, the Justice Department, was round up what they perceived to be the leadership of the Japanese-American community. And then there came calls for tolerance almost everywhere on the West Coast. Almost all the Japanese Americans lived on the West Coast. That lasted about 2 weeks. Hmm. And then the press, the LA Times, the Hearst newspapers, began to lie, really, about things that were going, that they were little brown men being sent to rape white women. And then once the press changed sides from tolerance to hatred, there was a kind of perfect storm of fear, and the fear was real. We had been attacked of racism. The racism was very real, and it had been going on for a long time. Lies promoted by both the government and the press, but the Japanese were an easy target and were racially vulnerable.
Yeah.
There had been anti-Oriental sentiment on the West Coast for 200 years.
And many people in the Seattle area were affected. You describe in your book
8,000 people from Seattle, mm-hmm, went into the camps, 13,000 from the state of Washington.
You describe how relocation unfolded on Bainbridge Island nearby back in 1942.
Right.
272 people. Describe what happened there.
Well, Bainbridge Island they picked because they wanted to test how much resistance the Japanese Americans would put in. As it turned out, they did not resist at all. They thought it was their patriotic duty to go into these camps. And they were also told that this was being done to protect them from violence from Caucasian vigilantes or American soldiers and whatnot. So in Bainbridge, the 272 people you mentioned, strawberry farmers, prosperous people, were rounded up and brought by ferry to Seattle, where they were met by the people of this town, spitting on them and throwing things at them. And it was, in some ways, it was the very first mass roundup. And it happened to happen the day after graduation at Bainbridge High School. And the Japanese kids who were under, Japanese-American kids, who were under curfew, could not go to their own prom or their own graduation. And in this case, which was rare, the white people on Bainbridge Island tried to protect the Japanese Americans. And one of the things they did, they were all crying as everyone marched on to the ferry, but one of the things was the Japanese could bring only what they could carry. That was the suitcases you mentioned, or sometimes a suitcase and a baby, and no pets. And so as they marched onto that ferry, the Japanese Americans, particularly the kids, were giving their dogs and cats to white friends. In some way, the dogs were more sensible than human beings were in that hysterical period after Pearl Harbor. Almost all the dogs refused to eat when their masters and mistresses went on the ferry and died within 2 weeks.
The people who were relocated from Washington State were sent to camps right here in Puyallup and also Manzanar, California. What were the conditions like in these internment camps?
Well, first you had the assembly centers. Here it was the livestock expositions. In San Francisco and L.A., it was race courses. 18,000 people lived in stables. And whole families. Disease was obviously rampant in that situation. That was done while the Army built these tar paper barracks based on prisoner of war camp plans throughout the West, and eight of them in the high desert West and two of them in the swamps of Arkansas. The Japanese still believing that they, Japanese Americans, still believing that they were being protected. But of course, when they closed the assembly centers, they were then put on sealed trains and taken to these camps. And of course, when they stepped off the trains, they saw that the machine guns, the spotlights, the guard towers were pointed inside, not outside. They were the prisoners, and that was the concentration camp, to use Roosevelt's word. That word changed over time, as we know.
We found out what the German concentration camps were.
So the word came to mean much more.
Yeah.
Many Japanese died or were killed in the camps, but it was nothing like Germany. And they were herded in there, and then you get this American story. These people were not Japanese. They had lived in America. Most of them had never seen Japan, could not speak Japanese, so that the story itself was American on both sides of the barbed wire. And in the beginning, there were terrible places that they went. They went places where no one had ever lived, and no one has ever lived since. The Owens Valley in California, Tule Lake, the lava beds, Minidoka, Iowa, Idaho, where most of the Seattle people were sent. These are places that had temperatures of 120 degrees in the summer and 30 below in the winter. And they didn't live in wood or stone buildings. It was tar paper nailed onto frames in areas with these kind of temperatures. There were no cooking facilities. There were no plumbing facilities. There was no water. There was one light bulb per barrack, and eight people, a family, might be living in a 16 by 12 foot space.
How did they live without water or cooking facilities?
Well, it was designed as a prisoner of war camp so that there was water in the camp. The latrines, which were just long boards open with holes every foot. It was very particularly difficult for women to do this, to do their business, as it were, in public. And then there were mess halls so that they would feed them almost around the clock. In the beginning, with food the Japanese could not digest, including leftover K rations from World War I. I don't think the Army intended to do this, but the effect of mess hall eating was to break down the Japanese American family. The kids, as soon as they got a chance, ran off and ate with their friends. The mothers, the fathers lost authority over them in that, and that down through the generation still resonates.
Richard Reeves is telling us the story of the Japanese internment in the U.S. during World War II in his new book, Infamy. Now, what's amazing about this story is that there were many Japanese Americans who got out of the camps and went to serve in the U.S. Army and fight distinguishedly in World War II against the Japanese. One, the story that many local people know, Roy Matsumoto, who died a couple years ago at the age 100 on Bainbridge Island. Tell us a little bit about these Japanese Americans who, despite the conditions inflicted upon them and their relatives, went to fight on behalf of the country that had done that to them.
Well, that's one of the great stories in dark stories in American history. There were 3,000 or so Japanese Americans in the U.S. Army when the war began. They were all discharged immediately on December 8th, many of them jailed. And until 1943, no Japanese from the West Coast could serve. There were some Japanese serving, some of them very heroically, people like a man named Ben Kuraki, who now lives in L.A., who took 58 bombing missions over both Europe and Japan. But he was from Nebraska, where there was no internment. The rest of the country didn't know, really, that this was going on. But by 1943, the people running the camps knew it was a disaster, that they were making enemies for the United States, and also we needed more manpower. We thought the war with Japan was going to be very short and needed manpower, and so went into the camps, and 30,000 Japanese Americans were drafted or enlisted. 18,000 of them, this is all in Europe, 18,000 of them were casualties. The 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which was a segregated union unit like the black units were in World War II, became per capita the most highly decorated unit in American military history. They fought in Europe. Even as they fought, and even as they were incredibly heroic, for instance, there was one of the great stories of the world, of the World War, was the rescue of the Lost Battalion, which was a Texas battalion, which was rescued by Nisei in the 442nd. However, if you read the New York Times after that happened, this dramatic accounting of how the soldiers were surrounded by Germans were rescued, the New York Times said they were rescued by doughboys. They never mentioned that the doughboys were Japanese Americans. The 442nd was also the first unit to fight its way to the outskirts of Rome, the first Axis capital that we captured. When they reached the border of the city, they were told to hold there, and for 2 days were kept in place while white troops were brought up to march triumphantly through Rome, and the Japanese Americans were taken in trucks away from the city. In the Pacific, totally unknown to, as you mentioned, Matsumoto, totally unknown to the American people, a secret, 6,000 Japanese, young Japanese, were part of something called the Military Intelligence Service. And they had the most difficult duty of the world. They were not only, very few Japanese Americans could speak fluent Japanese. They were the interrogators, the translators, and the cave flushers of the American Army, the Imperial Japanese Army soldiers who were determined not to surrender. They would rather commit suicide than surrender. Went into the caves at places like Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and these Americans, these young Americans, unarmed, would go into the caves and try to talk them into surrendering rather than killing themselves and the hostages they were holding. The bravery was unbelievable. I mean, and many of them, by the way, were killed by their own men. They saw a Japanese walking and assumed it was a Japanese spy in an American uniform.
So the Americans killed them. Americans killed the Japanese Americans who were fighting with them.
Yeah, and then two Marines were put with each of the Nisei to try to keep them from getting killed, and that didn't always work. They still were occasionally shot by their own people or by the Japanese because they were wearing American uniforms. The Japanese couldn't see the color of their skin, and they did these amazing things, like jumping up in the middle of a firefight and ordering the Japanese to charge into what were ambushes set up in advance. And one of the reasons they knew where the Japanese were and what they were going to do was because many of these guys would crawl through the jungle at night and then lay down outside Japanese camps and listen to what their plans would be for the next day and then crawl back.
Richard Reeves, what has the U.S. government done to try to make amends for this infamy, as the title of your book suggests, for this forced relocation of Japanese Americans? What has the U.S. government done, and do you feel as though it's been sufficient?
Well, it certainly has not been sufficient, and it didn't happen for more than 30 years, partly because, like combat soldiers who rarely talk about what they did and what they saw, particularly their families, the Japanese who were in the camps were the same. They didn't talk about it. They didn't want to talk about it. Many Caucasians, even their neighbors, didn't know what had happened. And it was when the Black Civil Rights Movement began, young Japanese Americans, Nisei and Sansei, began to ask their parents, what did you do during the war, Daddy? What happened? Where were you? The Japanese then began to talk. There were a couple of books mostly by women, mostly books for children, that talked about what had happened, because this curiosity exploded in the late 1960s and the early 70s. And because of that, Japanese not only organized, but some began to press for remuneration for what they had lost. And they had lost everything. They lost their farms. After all, you're put in a concentration camp. Your bank account is frozen. You can't pay your mortgage. You can't pay your insurance. The state takes over the land and gives it to somebody else as abandoned property. That's what was happening. And that's what, of course, parents didn't want to talk to their children about. But when the story began to come out, finally, in the mid-1970s, President Gerald Ford officially apologized to the Japanese. And then President Reagan and later President Bush, the first President Bush, signed legislation done in Congress giving each surviving, you had to still be alive, member $20,000, internees $20,000, which was a pittance compared to what many of them lost. The money was paid in 1994 dollars, so that, again, the dollar had depreciated in a way that this money was nothing compared to what they lost. Many, many of the Japanese Americans tore those checks up or gave them to white neighbors in the cases like Bainbridge Island, where the white people had watched over the property of the Japanese Americans. Again, that was rare. In most cases, the neighbors were only too anxious to get the Japanese land, their houses, their cars, and take whatever they could, break in, take whatever they could.
We've had wars since World War II, and certainly people of ethnicities and of nations that have been involved in those wars have suffered some sort of mistreatment, not kind of on the level that we saw during World War II with Japanese and Japanese Americans. Has the lesson been learned?
No. I'll tell you two things about the lesson. In the first place, we've been doing this from the very beginning. I mean, leaving aside the slaves and the Indians, the Chinese who came to build the railroads, the Eastern Europeans who came to work in slaughterhouses and mines, the Northern Europeans who farmed the high plains of the Middle West, Irish need not apply, the discrimination against Jews. It's a recurring theme in American history. The redemption for it is, I'm an American. I'm a hopelessly an American. I love my country. It's true that, but the pattern I see of this country built by immigrants is that they are hated, discriminated against, because they're not like us until they are us. and they are you, they are me, and that has continued. And the second part of it, and really the reason I wrote the book was because the laws that made this possible, which to me are clearly unconstitutional, are still on the books, so that if tomorrow we decided to round up Muslims and put them in camps or border crossers in the Southwest, the law still exists that the government has the power to create a military zone and remove anyone from that that they want to. When the Japanese-American habeas corpus cases were decided in 1944, they were held off until after the 1944 election because Roosevelt was afraid what he had done and would be an issue on the West Coast and might cost them, particularly California, to Tom Dewey, the Republican candidate. But when those cases, 2 days after that, by the way, 2 days after he was reelected, Roosevelt went on the radio to say what an outrage it was that these people were in camps and we had to do something about it. But Robert Jackson, one of the Supreme Court justices who decided those cases, noted in his dissent that the court never discussed the constitutionality of what happened. And the fact that those laws still survive then, he said, is a loaded pistol on the Constitution. They could be invoked tomorrow.